Hi, everyone. I'm Judy, and I'm an alcoholic. First, I'd like to thank the committee. This is a great honor. It's always an honor to come out and do service for Alcoholics Anonymous, considering where alcohol has brought me to. This is an honor. Even though this is just another open meeting, this is one big open meeting. I was sitting here, I was thinking how lucky the Hilton is that we're not drinking, because this place would be wrecked. All right, real quick. My sponsor suggested to me that I hit my knees and tell God, you know, my higher power, you know, if I got to sound like a moron, that's okay. Carry the message. So I did that. So if I sound like a moron, we can blame her and HP, okay? A little bit about myself. I come from the Bronx, and long before I picked up my first drink, there was a chip missing. And I had a lot of contributing factors, and I mention this because I was born a clean slate. You know, and I didn't come from a family that had an alcoholic mother, an alcoholic father, you know, and I didn't see active alcohol drinking in my home. But there was some trauma in my childhood, and I watched a lot of TV. And I learned very young how to compare myself. And I used to compare myself to little Julie, who lived across the alleyway. She had a mother, she had a father, she had Barbie dolls, the real Barbie, not the bogus ones. And from Woolworths. And I really, I envied her, and I felt different, you know, at 6 and 7 years old. And there were some things that were different. Like, my house didn't have a dad. My mom was my dad's mistress. I had four brothers, and all four of them were from different fathers. Well, actually, three of them were from different fathers. So I knew we were a little different. My mom's from Bermuda. My dad was from Austria. My father committed suicide when I was 13. So we were different. I'm sure there were other people that were different, but I felt different. And I would watch, like, the Brady Bunch, and I Dream a Genie, you know. And I remember I used to blink before I picked up a drink. I was blinking, you know. And I would fantasize about, like, coming from, like, I loved Green Acres because she would dress with that foo-foo, you know. And she lived in the country and had a pig, you know. But so there was a lot of feelings going on before I picked up a drink, so I was just waiting for a drink to happen, you know. And my first introduction to alcohol is my mom would have my uncles come up from Bermuda and visit her, and she would play music, and they would drink blackberry brandy. Real quick, I seen that they were happy, they were laughing, you know, and that was my first association with alcohol and happiness. You know, and I remember going in the kitchen as a kid and taking a shot out of the glass, and I got all giddy, and I came out and I dressed up as Sheer, and I entertained them, and they really loved me, you know. And I got another feeling inside that if I act a certain way, people will like me, you know, and I did that for a very long time. Anyway, my alcohol insanity happened right away. I moved into a neighborhood, and it was the coolest thing to do was to hang out on the corner, drink, and listen to rock and roll, you know. And I remember being like 14 years old. You know, at this point, my father had committed suicide, and I had no ambition. I just wanted to hang out on the corner and drink beer. And then I learned real young about, like, wine, Matus, Lances, you know. So I would stand on the corner with a cup while all the guys were drinking beer from a bottle, and I would drink in my cup and think I was better than them, you know. And that's how my life went. It went nowhere. It just progressively went nowhere. You know, I never went to school. I never had an education. You know, I didn't have a lot of discipline. My mom was pretty lenient with us. And that was really what I did. I would, like, you know, cut out of school, drink beer, drink wine, and wander aimlessly through the projects, you know. And I really liked, I drank alcohol. I never really knew until I got sober that alcohol was a contributing factor to the problem. I really honestly seen alcohol as the solution. And if I had to put alcohol in any kind of form, like if there was a sign over my head and it, like Charlie Brown, this is what he did to me. And it took away all of that. And that's what I drank. I drank for the effect. You know, the effect made me really comfortable in my skin. The only thing is that when I drank alcohol, and I put liquor in my body, I do really whatever I want, and I really don't have any consequential thinking. So I had, like, no ambition in life. My ambition was to, you know, my boyfriends owned an after hours, or they were crooks, you know. And that's really, like, was my ambition, to find a guy to take care of me for the rest of my life. And I liked the idea if they, you know, had a little club, you know. So I would, like, get dressed up, you know, go to the club in my neighborhood. I would get all dressed up. We had three little clubs, but I got a boyfriend that owned an after hours, or whatever it was. It was the club, you know. And I would drink. I would go there, and I always say this, like, in my head, I would come in, because it was the Farrah Fawcett days. I would come in all dressed up with those big flips, you know, and I looked like Farrah Fawcett. And then, like, within an hour and a half, I was, like, a mixture of the Hulk and Phyllis Diller. I'd be like, ah, you know. And then I'd start a lot of fights, and I'd torture them, and then I'd go somewhere else, you know. And then I'd stumble into my mother's house probably like 5, 6 in the morning, a wreck. You know, and that's how it went, just went on. But eventually, like, it started to get, like, I had no wife, and I was starting to get that feeling. I had been to Central Booking 9 times at this point, you know. And it really was not, you know, a nice scene. But I was a young girl. And the highlight of my life, it's her favorite story I hear, the highlight of my life was on Wednesday night. See, what alcohol did to me is it allowed me to live in a fantasy world. And whatever that was, you know, I could be Chinese, I could be African-American, you know. Anywhere I went, I fit in, and I would just act, you know. I like to pretend I was like some, you know, I knew this one, I knew that one, I was some mafia's girlfriend, you know. It's just like an illusion, and that's what it did. It contributed to the illusion. So I would dress up on Wednesday night. That was the highlight of my life, because Wednesday night was Dynasty. And I could pretend that I was Joan Collins, you know. And I learned how to drink martinis by this point. So I would put on that purple negligee, do my hair, do the makeup, and I would sit with those fluff slippers, and I would drink and pretend that I was Joan Collins. If I was drinking today, I'd be a desperate housewife, you know? So I would drink, and one day I was in that get-up, and I decided Egg McMuffins had just come out. And I decided I got to have an Egg McMuffin, and that's what liquor did to me. I had tunnel vision. I wanted to take what was not mine. I wanted to go here. I wanted to start trouble. I did it. So I get into this broken-down car that some guy gave me. I didn't even know about a driver's license. I didn't even park the thing. I used to pull it over. And I go to get an Egg McMuffin, and now I'm on an Egg McMuffin run. And I get pulled over immediately because I'm whacked, right? And I'm in that ghetto, you know? I don't look like Joan Collins. I look like Phyllis Diller at this point. And they take me to Central Booking. But this was common. And I'm in Central Booking. I know I'm not a hooker. I'm going for an Egg McMuffin. You know? But this was normal behavior, like dyeing your hair and putting foil paper on your head and then going to the bar, you know, with foil paper on your head. You know? Nobody said anything, so there was nothing wrong with it. You know, but my life was really getting sad, and inside, you know, at this point came a time when, you know, I was sleeping, and I really didn't like my life, and I wasn't really happy, and I was depressed, and I didn't know if I was depressed. I didn't even know the word mental when it's over, you know, but I really was just not happy. There was something missing, you know, and I would watch people, like, go on with their life, and I was still going to the club, you know. So I was sitting in Central Booking, and at this point, a friend of Alice was murdered in our apartment under a drunken stupor, and was pushed out the window, and my mom split. You know, I was 19 years old, and she went to Bermuda because she was out of control. So I had nowhere to go, you know, and I was in Central Booking, and I was facing some serious time because this was my ninth time in Central Booking. You know, I always knew somebody who knew somebody, but there's somebody was running out at this point. And I asked God to help me. You know, I didn't have really an understanding of a higher power of my own. I had that one of my mom's who was like the man in the white robe that like watched everything I did and was going to hell since I was 7. But I did. I asked him to help me. And he sent me to meet you people. That's what happened, you know. There was a little drift in the road, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I heard the woman who was my sponsor today speak at a group up on the Grand Concourse. You know, I was really taught, I got to say. You know, I was taught, not only, I was fortunate, because she went beyond the call of duty, a sponsorship, and she took me in, and she housed me. And she taught me a lot of things. And I mention that because, you know, it's easy when someone tells you this is how it works, but she showed me how it worked. You know, there was always people in her house. She was always helping people. She was always going on commitments. And I joined the group, and the group that I joined, we got active very early in sobriety. And my life changed, and I got sober, you know, and I got a life. You know, I got a life. But I had a little reservation because I still believe that I, you know, how it works, talks about. There was no easier, softer way. And really, have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly following our path? Well, I started lying and I started manipulating, probably in my fifth year of sobriety. But it started a long time before that, I must say. Anyway, we know where this is going, right? All right, so I got married, you know, and it all became about money. And Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, was really not important. And I still was looking for someone to take care of me. You know, and I really didn't establish a relationship with a higher power of myself. And I moved out to Long Island, and on the outside it looked real good. And that hole that we know that we all have, that hole had returned, and it became so big. And, you know, I lost my child, you know. And I went into I had drank before that, and I had tried to come back, but I was really looking for an easier, softer way, and I had a reservation. Anyway, I seen these two ladies drinking those little cocktails in a Cantonese restaurant, and they looked happy, and that's what I've always been looking for. I want to be happy, you know, and I picked up a drink. And if you would have told me that I was going to drink, you know, and where it would have taken me, I would have never in a million years believed. That was my journey, you know. Picked up a drink, and I lost my son. I lost any kind of dignity that I had acquired here. Forget about material things. They were gone, you know. That just comes with the game. But I became homeless, and I ended up in the street, you know, and I caught a new charge, and at this point I was sentenced to 3.5 to 10 to prison, and I ran away. And just like the great alcoholic, I went to live in Pennsylvania, and I figured I'll just drink Australian wine now, and I'll be okay. And the insanity of it is that I got locked up, and I was working in a sports bar, you know, stealing frog legs. Like, who steals frog legs, you know? And I joined a dark team, and I tried to chameleon in, but alcohol now had turned on me because it was no longer working. It was no longer making me feel. I had reaped the rewards of sobriety, and I knew that, like, this was not correct. And so I got pinched up in Pennsylvania, and I was waiting to be expedited to New York, and this is the insanity. New York never came to get me. And I got to walk out of jail up there, and that was a jail, not a prison. And I walked out of jail up there, and my only goal was to get to my neighborhood, because at 10 o'clock the liquor store closed, and that's what I did. And I went on another run, and I ended up in the streets of Manhattan, homeless. For those who have traveled the bus to Rikers Island, I was a smelly woman on the bus. You know, it came to a point I was about 90 pounds, which I wish I weighed 90 pounds now. About 90 pounds, and I lived homeless in the street, and I hated myself, and my praise consisted of, God, please let me die. You know, and I really wanted to die. I hated myself. I hated what had come from my life, and I was stuck in it. You know, and there was no more fancy martinis and big hair. You know, my clothes, I lived in the St. James Hotel, the Chelsea Hotel, and once in a while, if I did a little bit of a score, I'd make it out of St. Mark's, you know, because they were like $22 for the night. And this is how I lived, you know, and I just wanted to drink and stay in that state of mind, but not enough alcohol could kill the pain that was in my heart. It was a horror. You know, I lived a horror behind a drink, and my behavior was no better. Forget about being ethical. I was, like, off the hook, and it's amazing that I'm alive, and I have a parent that's a senior today. She was a senior then, and I had called her, and I said, can I come to your house? And I had a warrant over my head, And she said, oh, yeah, come here. And then I tortured her for another year. And I tortured her neighborhood. And I just wanted to drink. And at this point, I was grubbing change on the corner to get country club beers because they were 50 cents. You know, and the most humiliating feeling I got is I looked at my mother and she had a companion. And I said, can you give me $2? Can you give me $2? And he went downstairs and he bought a six-pack of beer and he kicked it across the kitchen floor. And my hands were shaking and I drank the beer and I started crying because the beer didn't work. And that's how it went. You know, I was very fortunate. I put in charge, you know, and prison saved my life. You know, for the people who do service behind the walls, they carry the message to me while it's in Bedford Hills, and that's why I'm here today. You know, that in a higher power, in people. I went to prison. Here's the insanity of alcoholism. I'm sitting in prison. I have been out 4 to 12 and a 3 and a half to 10 that I'm already sentenced on. And I got consecutive bids going, for those of you who know what I'm talking about. And I'm sitting in Bedford Hills, and I'm making hooch. I was almost going to mention my last name. So the CL calls me, because they call you by your last name, and they go, I smell liquor in here. And it hit me once again that I was about to drink, and my behavior under the influence of alcohol had put me in this predicament. And I never really thought that I would be out. You know, I don't know, I'm here, you know, and that's by God's grace. It truly is by God's grace that I'm in the street. And I made it out of my road. It's been pretty, you know, it's been a journey. It's a continuous journey. And I came out of prison, and there's women in this room today. You know, I came out, I had no clothes. This is, like, awesome. It really is. I'm about to cry, and I don't cry easy. I came out of prison, and I was a messenger in the street, you know, and I was on work release, and I was making meetings with the Mustard Seed and those groups downtown on 27th Street. And I ran into a member of my home group on Park Avenue, and the flame was lit. I have to mention this gentleman bought me a big book when I was in Bedford Hills, and it was the first time that I sat still with myself in the big book, because there was a lot of distractions, you know, shopping. You know, they can't do that in, you know, prison. Your conversary takes 2 weeks if you order something, you know. So there's no instant gratification. And I sat and I read the doctor's opinion. And my sponsor was really big on how it works, you know, and I read there was a solution and the flame was lit. And I started to make meetings when I got to a prison called Albion. And the message was carried to me. It really was. It's a great service to the people who go behind the walls. And anyway, I went out, came home on work release, 18 months of work release, and I was making meetings on work release, and I ran into a friend, a fellow group member, who told me to come back, and the flame was lit again. And I made it back to my home group, you know. And eventually the group closed, and I'm in this group tonight, the Tremont group that I'm here for that group, as a member of that group. I'm confused there. But anyway, my life has totally changed. Not only has my life changed, this program changed my heart, you know, and I say that sincerely. You know, the people that have been put in my life are not people who told me what to do. These were women and men who showed me by their own actions, you know. I had a sponsor who showed me early sobriety. I got sober the first time in 86, you know, to get on my knees and ask a higher power to help me to stay sober. So some of this stuff was instilled in me. And I don't know, you know, I have a parent that's in a nursing home. Had I not been sober, she's in a nursing home because I was able to make healthy decisions based on what was best for her. You know, this is a lady that was cutting the money out of her underwear, you know, to drink beer while she was sleeping. You know, I have a brother who's also in prison who depends on me for a phone call and a package. These are big things to me. I was able to go back to school because I got sober. I got a little bit of an education. I mean, you know, not much, but a little bit. And, you know, I'm in school again, you know, doing something else. You know, I'm a good employer when I show up. I'm not always there, but when I'm there, I'm good. You know, yeah, that's true. You know, I'm a good tenant, you know, I'm a good merchant, and I'm a good friend. You know, and if there's anybody out here that's struggling with a drink, or who's maybe just coming back, you know, that doesn't have that feeling in their heart that they can do this again. I don't know. You know, I know you can do what I did because you're given the same opportunity that I was given. You know, and I can't say, oh, if I could do it, you could do it. But I can't say no. You know, if you're given the same opportunity as I was given, you can do it too. You know, and I wouldn't trade this today. You know, one thing I know, I got a lot of work to do. And I'm not going to say I'm not perfect by no means. The difference is today, like, I accept it. I can say I'm sorry. It may take a little while, but I say it. You know, I know when I'm not correct, you know, and I try to live the right way. You know, and I try to carry this message, not only, you know, inside the rooms, but outside of the rooms. You know, and it's nothing I wouldn't do for another alcoholic or another human being, and that wasn't me. You know, that's the power of the 12 steps. So I want to thank you guys for asking me to share in this event. And I'm Judy, I'm an alcoholic.
Wow. Did anybody got a drink out there? Oh, my God. I'm so nervous. Woo! I just need 1 minute so I can ask my higher power to speak through me so you can hear my higher power and not my nonsense today. Thank you. My name is Deborah, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. I didn't have a drink today, and for that, I'm truly, truly grateful. I'm grateful that I woke up in a sober state of mind. I'm grateful that I woke up this morning, and I'm not in the bullpen, balled up in a knot because the body is craving the alcohol, not because I want it. I'm grateful that when I woke up this morning, and I went outside, and I turned around, and I saw the police siren, I didn't have to duck because they wasn't looking for me today. I'm grateful that when I woke up this morning and I went outside, I didn't have to look around for the long shot because I'm trying to duck him because the money I have, I don't want to give it to him because I need to buy me a drink. I'm grateful that when I woke up today and I told my son that I was going and I would be back tomorrow, he said okay because he truly, truly knew I was coming back today. I'm grateful that when I woke up this morning, even though I gave my husband fever because I was nervous, I woke up to the same man today. And all that is because I didn't drink, all of that is possible. And I need to let you people know that I'm a blackout drinker because when I came to, I had 4 kids. And I don't know where these kids came from, but they told me that they belong to me. So I truly, truly know I can't drink today because if I drink and me and my husband go in that room, it's going to be another child going on. So I'm grateful that I know I can't drink today. You know, I came from a family that drink. That's what my family did. Every occasion and any occasion, my family drink. And as a little girl growing up, I just saw the glamour of the alcohol. I saw the cigarette smoking. I saw the finger popping. I saw the dancing. I saw the pretty glasses. I just saw the glamour of the alcohol. See, I never connected the alcohol to the ambulance coming at the house, the police coming at the house, my uncle in the room with my aunt, and it's not the aunt he's married to. See, I never connected none of that stuff to the alcohol. You know, so, you know, my family, when we start drinking, anybody look like the person we married to. You know what I'm saying? So I'm grateful I don't drink today. You know? I know. And alcohol is a great remover. It removed a lot of things out of my life, you know, and what it mainly removed out of my life was a lot of jobs. I had a lot of good jobs. But see, when I was drinking, truly, what my employer wanted me to do was too, too much. And he wanted me to do things like come to work Monday to Friday. Take a 15-minute break. Take an hour for lunch. And this is the one he wanted me to do that I truly, truly couldn't do. He wanted me to come to work the day after payday. You know, when I had something to do the day after payday, and it was not to come to work. And I'm an arrogant alcoholic when I'm drinking. So now it's been a couple of days, and I haven't been to work. And I come to work with this attitude. Don't mess with me. I didn't come to work today. And so he would say, okay, Deborah, it's okay. You're fired. But you see, when he said that, that was okay. Because the disease told me all I have to do is go to the bar, have a couple of drinks, and I'ma get another job. Like they was hiring in the bar. Like they was looking for anyone with my qualifications in the bar, drunk for hire. But you know the disease told me that. It told me that because all I really wanted to do was drink. You know, and alcohol is a great illusion. It'll lie to you. You know, I remember, I love Billy D. My husband know I love Billy D, and Billy D is aging very, very gracefully. You know what I'm saying? So, I'm sitting in the house, and Billy D came out with this Coke 45 commercial, right? So I'm like, yeah, Coke 45, Billy D, and me. You know what I'm saying? But I need to let you know that I drunk a lot of Coke 45 and Billy D never showed. He never showed. Because you know what? The bottom line is, after I had enough of Coke 45 in my system, everybody here looked like Billy D to me. It don't matter. You know what I'm saying? So now I'm on this crazy drinking route, you know, and I don't know about anybody in here, but you see, when I was drinking, I always had these great ideas, you know, and I didn't hang around with females because y'all was too catty and you wasn't going to protect me, so I hung out with the guys because they was going to protect me. Just keep listening to my story. So now, I started hanging out with these guys, you know, and we drinking. And when I'm in the grips of my disease, anything seems like a good idea at the time. So now, I'm in Brooklyn. I'm in these people's house, and I'm drinking. Somebody said, let's go to Staten Island to steal. Didn't know what Staten Island was, but it just seemed like a good idea at the time. So I leave Brooklyn, me and these four guys that was going to protect me, and we go to Staten Island to steal. And we in Staten Island Mall, and guess who get caught? Now, it's been 14 years, and I ain't seen those four guys that was going to protect me since. So now I'm in JCPenney, and I get caught, and the lady detective takes me downstairs, and I start to cry. And she said, what are you crying for? They're only going to give you a disappearance unless you have a warrant. Unless you have a warrant. See, that's why I was crying, because every time I got caught, I would do this thing, catch me if you can. And then when they would catch me and I would face the judge, I would say a prayer. God, if you just get me out of this one, I swear I'm not going to drink again. I swear I'm going to take care of my kids. Just get me out of this one. And he would do it. He would get me out. And as soon as I hit the street, I said, God knows I'm a liar. God knows I'm an alcoholic. God knows I'm going to drink again. And that's what I would do. I would drink again. So when I got caught in JCPenney's And I went to Staten Island, and the judge in Staten Island looked at my rap sheet, and he wasn't too happy with me. You know what I'm saying? So Staten Island sent my behind to Rikers Island. And in Rikers Island was where I got a rude awakening. My mother, God bless her soul, my biggest enabler. See, I know I could always call my mother, and she would come to my rescue. So now I'm in Rikers Island, and I'm crying, still crying, and I called my mother. And she picked up the phone, and I remember as if it was yesterday. She said, "Hi, honey, where you at?" So I said, crying, "I'm in Rikers Island." So my mother said to me, "Ah, you made it to the big house this time, didn't you?" And you see, I didn't want to hear that. I wanted to hear what my mother always said to me. "What can I do for you this time?" There comes a time in our loved one's lives when they just get tired. They get tired of the lies. They get tired of the promises. They just get tired. And my mother was truly, truly tired of me. So now, I'm back at Staten Island, and it's these people are there. And they come over to me and they ask me, "Do you have a problem with alcohol?" And I'm arrogant. I look at them and I say, "No, I don't have a problem. The only problem I have is I want to go home." So that's what they did. They sent me home, back to Rikers Island. Because you see, I forgot at the time that that was my house. I forgot I was living in Rikers Island. So now I'm making bus tours to all these different boroughs, answering all these warrants. And I wind up back in Staten Island. And the people come over to me again, and they ask me again, "Do I have a problem?" And I ask my lawyer, "Who are these people that keep asking me, do I have a problem?" And he said, "These people are tasked. And if you say you have a problem with alcohol, you could go to treatment and you don't have to go to jail." See, I heard you don't have to go to jail. You see, because the judge in Staten Island was not happy with me. So right away, I admit I have a problem. I really didn't think I had a problem. I just didn't want to go to jail. So now I'm in treatment, you know, and I'm still got that mentality that there's nothing wrong with me. Things is going on with all these people here. You know, they need to be in treatment, but I got a master plan, and it's not to stay sober. You know, and I don't know what happened. You know, they say if the program will get you, and it did. And they told me that I had to do a few simple things. They said, "You need to get a sponsor, Deborah." And I was like, "A sponsor?" I thought a sponsor was another female trying to get in my business because she didn't have no business. You know, like I had any business, really, because every time the police came to the Marcy Projects with this picture and knocking on people's doors saying, you know this lady, they know it was the crazy lady on the fifth floor. So now I get into Alcoholics Anonymous and I got business, you know? And I'm real thankful for my first sponsor, and she's no longer here. You know, her higher power decided that he needed her a little more. But I'm real grateful for her because she got me into service. She was always doing something. She was always doing service, you know. And I remember it was a group anniversary, and she was in the kitchen, and she was always doing something. And she started waving her finger for me to come to her. So I looked at her, and then I went in there to her, and she said, "Cut the cake." And I said, "Cut the cake?" She said, "Yes, cut the cake." I said, "I didn't come here to cut no cake. I came here to eat some cake." You know what I'm saying? So she told me, she said, "You know what? You're going to cut the cake, and you're going to go around there, and you're going to smile because you're so self-centered, and you think it's all about you." So I said, "Okay." So I cut the cake, and I'm walking around, and I'm throwing the cake at people. You know, I'm just throwing it on the table, you know, and because I want somebody to say something to me so I can tell my sponsor, "See, I told you they don't appreciate me." But you know what? No one never said anything. They just looked at me and they said, "Thank you." And I was like, "Thank you. Woo, these people are crazy around here." You know what I'm saying? But that was because I was crazy, you know, and I'm real, real grateful for service, you know, because then I had to start doing other service in the home group. And they told me, if you do secretary, if you do GSR, if you do literature, you know, all that time you'll be sober. And they gave me the keys. And I thought that it was my house. You know what I'm saying? And I had to be there on time because I believe that if I didn't get there to open up, those people was going to drink, you know? But I'm grateful because that what kept me going. That's what kept me going. You know, and I like to say that if it's anybody here, if you in this room because your loved one's telling you that they can't take you anymore, and if you don't stop drinking, they're going to leave you, you're in the right place. If you're here because your parole or your probation officer told you that you need not to drink or you're going to go to jail, you're in the right place. If you're here because ACS are going to take your kids and you don't want them to take your kids, you're in the right place. Whatever reason you're here, if you're not drinking today, you're in the right place. And I would like to thank the committee for asking me to share. Is truly, truly an honor because no one used to ask me to do anything but leave, you know. Leave, Deborah, and please don't come back. You know what I'm saying? So I'm real, real grateful that they asked me to share. And I just want to also say that I'm real grateful for my sponsor. You know, she didn't feel all that great, you know, but she's still here to support me. And all the people that are here, and you know who you are, that came here to support me, you know, unconditional love. I could never get that when I was out there drinking. Never. Thank you for letting me share.
My name is Stacy. I'm a grateful alcoholic. I want to thank Tom for that non-pressure introduction. And I want to thank the committee for this honor, which is fantastic. And Deborah and Judy, you guys were hilarious. You got to go on tour. You know, when I was coming up here, I was thinking about, you know, the part in Bill's story, and Bob has the same thing where they're always talking about, before I do that, Stacy, grateful alcoholic, my home group is the Atlantic group. My sobriety date is October 18th, 1987. My sponsor's name is Tom H., and it's an honor. But I was thinking about when the Lois getting up here and reading Bill's words, and also when Bill talks about his terrible drinking, and he says it went on for 5 more years. You know, this literal hell went on for 5 more years. And Dr. Bob says we have some uncanny ability to find, you know, the kindest women or something of that. And I know in my life that's the case. And, you know, I want to thank my wife for being there for me, because there's a lot of time that I'm speaking or, you know, I'm doing 12-step calls, and I'm a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, there's those unsung heroes who have been there to support us. And so I want to say thank you to my wife. If you think I'm going to be as funny as Deborah, I'm not. If I could just get that out of the way. So I am a byproduct of really strong, wonderful sponsorship. And I got sober originally on the West Coast. And the very first meeting I ever went to went like this. I had just gotten out of a detox. They told me go straight to a meeting and go get a sponsor. And I get out and I go to the Brentwood Men's Stag. and there's a podium just like this, and this guy gets up, he looks like he's out of central casting from Sopranos, and he says, "Gentlemen, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you plan to stay sober, buy a black suit, because we go to funerals of people who like to pick up." And then he said, "If you don't plan to stay sober, buy a black suit so we know what to bury you in. Now, who would like to share?" That was my first meeting. They didn't care about your feelings. They didn't care about what your therapist thinks. They didn't care about where you came from. They only cared about what you did. They only cared about the steps. These men weren't afraid to crosstalk. You'd get up there and start talking about your cell phone bill or some other stuff, and they, or you get, you know, her or him or the job or the this or the that, and they would bring you right back into the steps, or they'd cut you off and say, "Keep coming back. Next." Because if you weren't there about the solution, they didn't care. And so at this meeting, I stood up and, you know, I still had my hospital band on, and I raised my hand, and they called on me, and I came up, and I said, "I'm Stacy. I just got out of the hospital today, and I need a sponsor," and I sat down. And I get a tap on my shoulder, and this guy, Eli, comes up to me, and he looked a little bit like Woody Allen meets Albert Einstein. And now this is 1987. There's some hip, sober people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know maybe I might get Clint Eastwood or De Niro or somebody to be my sponsor, but instead I get Albert Einstein and Woody Allen. And he walks up to me and he says, "My name is Eli. I'm going to be your sponsor." Now, back then, they didn't say, "Here's my sponsorship credentials, here's my number, call me if you like me, you know, maybe we can date for 30 days. They didn't care. They were like, "I'm your sponsor." And so Eli said, "I'm going to be your sponsor. Meet me at the Early World Diner tomorrow and bring your big book." And I showed up at the Early World Diner, and Eli was sitting in this diner waiting for me prompt. And he had this big book. The spine was gone. It was a hardcover that was now a paperback. He had tabs all over it. And he had a big rubber band around it because it was all apart. And he said, "This is the owner's manual for your alcoholic brain. If you do what's in this book, you'll never drink again." And I love it when I hear statistics about Alcoholics Anonymous not working. I have never seen it not work if you truly work what's in there, right? It's always, "I stop working it." It's not that it stopped working. So anyway, so he opens up this book and he starts at the copyright line. And that's when I know I'm in trouble. And I'm one of those people that I used to do book reports by reading the table of contents, and I would just guess at the rest of it. I never read a foreword to anything, you know. And so he starts at the copyright line, and I said, "Eli, I'm sorry, why are we reading the copyright line?" He says, "You need to know when this was written. It affects your life. You need to understand in context." And if you, this is some crazy statistics. To put us in this room in context, there's 20 billion people on the planet. 10% of society suffers from some form of alcohol or chemical addiction, so that's 2 billion people. There's 2 million people in Alcoholics Anonymous, which of the world population and of the ones who are in some form of addicted, we make up 0.001%. That's how rare it is. If you even make it to the rooms, and if you have a meeting like ours, you walk right in front of homeless people that are feet away from the answer and may never step inside that church and know, right? That's how rare of a gift it is of us sitting in this room. And then half of us aren't going to make it, right? So then you cut that in half. So it's sobering. So anyway, so Eli, he's going through the big book and he's, you know, I read a page, he reads a page. I read a page, he reads a page. We're going back and forth. And he starts, we get to the fourth step. Now, if you haven't chosen a sponsor, choose wisely. My sponsor happened to be a little bit older, and Eli had two hearing aids. And Eli was all about doing everything in this diner. And see, my fourth step was the greatest secrets known to man. And I know you're like me. You've sat in a meeting and you've looked at those two shades hanging down and you read up to 9 and 4 and you know what's going to happen. So anyway, I know where Eli's going. And I said, Eli, can we do this at your house or something? You know, he said, no, 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 the diner's fine. These people do not care about you. Don't worry about it. So if you've ever been in a diner, there's somebody sitting in the boot right next to you, right? So I've got these greatest secrets known to man. And I lean over and I whisper something and Eli says, what? I can't hear you. And I lean over and I say it a little louder and he starts to turn his hearing aids up. And you know the older ones where they feed back a little bit, that little ooh. And now he can't hear and he needs me to speak up. And then the thing that was embarrassing about this is every time I would share something, he'd share something worse. But he was so proud of it. Oh, you kissed your cousin? I slept with mine. You know? Everything was worse. And what was amazing was, at the end of that, I felt a little more a part of the world. There was one person that I thought, okay, understands me, right? There was one person. And as we're walking out, we read all the way up through 6 and 7. Eli was all by the book. If it wasn't in the book, he didn't do it. You know, he was like, this is the manual. So we read up to 6 and 7, and there's a 7-step prayer. And we walk out on San Vicente Boulevard, and he says, do you have your keys with you? And I said, yeah. And I show him my keys. He goes, drop them on the ground. And I said, for what? And he says, just drop them on the ground. I drop them on the ground. You can't make this stuff up in AA. I drop him on the ground, and he says, pick him up. And as I go down to pick him up, he pops open his big book to the 7-step prayer. He grabs my hand, and he starts saying the 7-step prayer on one knee on San Vicente Boulevard. And I'm looking at him, and he's got my hand, and he said, we just read your 4th step. You did a lot of things when you were drunk. You hardly care about what people think. You know, get out on one knee. And so basically I read the 7-step prayer on San Vicente Boulevard, right in front of the Early World Diner. He was all about ego smashing. These guys did not care. And so I did what he said, right? And that day I walked different. You know, that day I felt different. That day something had changed my life. And as I went on, I continued to follow everything that Eli did, and we got to the point where I needed to make my amends. And I go, and I was a thief. I was a chronic shoplifter, and I had never been caught. And my thing was, when I was in school, I worked at record stores, so I knew how to get past the security systems. So I had all these record stores that I needed to go make these amends to. And so he said, I want you to write out your amends list from easiest to hardest and bring it back next week. So I'm like, whew, okay, I got putting some real easy stuff up on the top, and way at the bottom I put, you know, the hard things. all the shoplifting and everything, anything having to do with money was on the bottom. And he said, great, we're going to start from the bottom up. So the first one, and I don't know if you've ever pleaded and bargained with your sponsor. I said, Eli, listen, I don't think you understand, but this is all stealing. And if I go and tell him I stole, I'm going to jail. And what good am I going to be to Alcoholics Anonymous in jail? He cracks open the book and he says, it said we must be willing to go to any lengths. If not, we'll get drunk again. Quoting the book to me. So I said, all right, I'll make a deal. If I go and make this amends and they take me to jail, can I call you? He said, yep, make me your first call. So I go to this record store and I walk in and I think I owe him like 200 bucks or something like that. And I go in this record store and there's this, you know, young lady with her clipboard doing inventory in the middle of the day, chewing gum, listening to Joan Jett or something. And I walk up to her and I said, excuse me, can I see the manager? And she's like, oh. And I said, you know, I need to speak to the manager. She goes, I'm the manager. And I said, well, listen, I'm sober now, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I need to make an amends for some stuff that I did. And she says, can I see you outside? And I'm thinking, great, they're going to call the cops or something, and here we go. And so she takes me outside. We kind of go slightly around the corner from the front door, and she goes, okay, go ahead. And I said, so I've got this money. I need to make this amends. I used to come here. I used to shoplift, and you know, I'm sorry for what I did, blah, blah, blah. And she starts crying. And I'm like, what? And she says, I think you're a sign from God because my father is an alcoholic and we're trying to figure out how to get him help. And I went to my truck and I got a meeting book and I circled some meetings and I handed it to her, and she's giving me a hug, and I said, okay, but I got to give you this money. And she goes, I can't take your money. And I go, but I got to give it to you. And I said, if you guys have a charity or something, but, you know, and she just says, thank you, and please stay sober, and good luck to you. And, you know, I never saw again. So they had pagers back then, and you had quarters. You didn't have, you know, cell phones, and so I call Eli from a payphone, and he says, are you calling me from jail? I say, no. He says, what happened? I tell him the story. He says, that happens all the time. And he says, is it odd or is it God? You know. And he says, maybe you were supposed to go there to make that amends for that very purpose. And that started to happen. I would make these amends and the weirdest things. You walk in some place and these things that are coincidence or are not, you know, they start happening. So, you know, things went well and everything kept moving. And like I said, the sponsorship that I've gotten has really changed my life. And so I had a few years, got a job in New York, moved here. And Judy kind of talked about this. Suddenly I got here and I started coasting. I was sponsoring one person. I was going to one meeting and, you know, just kind of like, I got this AA thing, right? And I don't know if this is the case for you, but it is for me that I don't have a drinking problem. I have a thinking problem. And it's not my problems that are my problems. It's my solutions to my problems that are my problems. And so my name is Stacy, but my head's name is Rufus. And Rufus comes up with these ideas of how to get things done because I like the shortest distance between two points, right? Least work, most cash and prizes. How do I get that without doing anything? I am hardwired like that even to this day, right? And so all of my relationships with you are all about, can I get what I want through you? You're either going to help me get it or you're standing in my way, right? And so I have this brain that doesn't work quite right. And, you know, when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous, English wasn't my first language. My first language was Vietnamese. And if you don't know what that is, I'm going to tell you how to spot it in someone. You'll say something to them. It's usually a sponsee. And you'll say something to them. And they'll say, yeah, but let me explain. Or, they did it to me first. If they didn't do that, I wouldn't have done what I did. Right? It's never your fault. Right? So I get to New York. And my life begins to unravel. And I was asked to speak at the Atlantic Group, which was my home group. And I was sponsorless. And I do not suggest that on my worst enemy. And I confessed to someone that I don't have a sponsor. And I ended up getting my sponsor's one of the co-founders of the Atlantic Group, who's at the big meeting in the sky now, whose name is Van. And so I'm together with my wife, and Van starts introducing me to some new ideas, and I'd like to share them with you. And through this strong sponsorship, and some of what I'm going to say I've also gotten from Tom. So one of the first things was, Van says to me, if you plan to have a successful relationship, you must give 100% with no expectations in return. He called it the 100% rule. I said, where is that in the literature? All of my relationships are based on 50-50. The problem with this, I always believe I'm giving more than you are. But my relationship, you do your part, I'll do my part, and we're good, right? But I never believe you're working as hard, because, see, I compare how I feel to how you look, right? And they never add up. You look like you got your life together. I feel like a wreck. Therefore, you're not doing your part. So Van tells me about this 100% rule, and he says it's on page 115 in the 12 and 12. Go read it. And I read it, and it talks about, you know, we gave without expectations and all of this stuff. And so he says, if I plan to have a successful marriage, I need to learn to do that. That was such a big idea that I didn't know was in the literature, right? Revolutionary for me. And he used to have this saying, he says, would you rather be right or would you rather be happy? You know, I'd call him up complaining. You want to be right or you want to be happy? Happy. Good, go back and apologize and go buy some flowers and keep it moving, right? And that was the big idea. Do I want to be right or do I want to be happy? I want it to be right at all costs. You know, let napalm fly as long as I'm right, right? Let's torch it as long as I'm right. And one of the other ideas that got introduced was the first step says, I'm powerless over drinking, my life is unmanageable. And if you read in the doctor's opinion, several times it refers to, it says like eight times, it talks about mental, right? A mental deficiency, weird and mental blank spots. It talks about how the alcoholic can't, you know, use thinking properly. It's not even about drinking, right? So the second half of that first step about my life being unmanageable all has to do with step two. It literally says in step two that I am insane, but it doesn't say anything about my drinking, right? So I don't need to just stop drinking. I can be insane anytime I want. And usually it happens without my knowledge. And Rufus is in there, he's taking over and he's running the show, and I don't even know it's happened. And that has helped save my life to understand I actually suffer from a mental illness, right? That I'm bodily and mentally different from my fellows. And then when I drink, I compound it, right? But I have a mental illness and I have to be restored to sanity. So I want to tell this brief story that proves that point. About 2 years ago, my wife and I have a daughter. And we live down in the West Village, and a lot of the buildings are older. And there's this building that was behind us that has a smokestack. And it was an illegal smokestack that kind of sat right outside of our window. And in the wintertime, this couple behind us would, you know, burn their logs. And you had to choose between turning on the heat or are you going to get smoke in the apartment. So sometimes we would go and it would be cold. And so this one particular night, you know, I'd go over and knock on the buzzer and knock on their door. And the gentleman would always come over the intercom and say, sorry, the log's about to burn out, you know. So this one particular time, our daughter's sick. It's cold. I've put a green trash bag around the AC. I've taped the doors trying to keep this smoke from coming in. It's very cold. The wind is coming off the river and smoke's coming in our house and we're cold and coughing. And I don't even want to get out of bed, but I get out and I go over and I buzz the buzzer. And the guy comes on in that voice, oh, sorry, the log's about to burn out. And his wife grabs the intercom from him and says, listen, just because your house isn't properly insulated isn't our problem, and you need to get your apartment fixed and stop coming over here and don't ever buzz this buzzer again. Click. I have 20 years at this point sober. And you know how you don't even remember walking home? Coming out of that blackout. I haven't had a drink. I called my sponsor that morning. I talked to my sponsees. I prayed and meditated. I got 20 years. I went down in our basement, and we have this tall yellow ladder that you can change light bulbs up in the lobby. And I walk into the house with this ladder, and my wife says, what are you doing? And I said, mind your business. And I go out to the balcony, and I'm putting this ladder across our building to their building. And I've got a cinder block that I'm going to go put on the flute so we can let them know what smoke feels like in their apartment so we can call the cops and have a conversation. This is my best thinking at 20 years sober. So my wife, in her wisdom, pushes that emergency button and she yells, call your sponsor. So I close the door on the balcony and I dial Tom's number, hoping he doesn't pick up. Cause I'm done. I'm ready for it. I'm ready to let's get it on. My adrenaline's going. And Tom says, it's a late call. What are you doing calling me so late? And I tell him the story and he says, why don't you put the ladder back and call me tomorrow? I open the door, my wife says, what'd your sponsor say? I went and put the ladder back and I called Tom the next morning. And Tom said, you know, I call him, I check in, and I'm explaining, you know, everything. And, you know, the yeah, but you don't understand. And he says, okay, I got a game plan for you. Why don't you write a letter to the building department? Come on, Tom. You don't think we've tried this? We've been working on this for years. And he kind of pulls this, are you willing to go to any lengths? Are you willing to follow direction card, you know, that sponsors like to pull on you? Yeah, sure. Okay, you talk and I'm going to write and I'm going to do whatever you say just to prove that you're wrong. I didn't say that to him, but that's what I'm thinking. So, Tom's direction. Write a letter to the building department. Go take pictures. Put on my nice suit. And go down there and take this letter to them. It's not going to work, but I'm going to do it. So I do everything that Tom says, and I get dressed up how you told me how to get, you taught me in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I put on this letter directly to the head of the building department. I go straight up to the top floor. I walk in, there's this receptionist behind this big desk, and I say, I'm here, here's my situation, here's my envelope, here's my pictures, here's the letter, and I just wanted to bring this. And I'm going to leave it. And she says, okay, thank you very much. We'll have someone get in touch with you. I know what's going to happen. I get back to my office, and I have a call on my cell phone. It's the head of the building apartment assistant. She says, we're going to have someone come out tomorrow. The very next day, they come out, and my wife calls me. And again, I think nothing's going to happen. My wife calls me and she says, the buildings department is up on the roof giving them a citation for having an illegal smokestack. So it was Sunday night when I was about to put the letter. Monday, I took the letter. Tuesday, they're on top of the roof. On Friday, they fined them and made them cement seal it on Friday. So, if you're new, the moral of the story is, it doesn't matter how much time you got. It doesn't matter how smart you think you are. It doesn't matter how many people you work with. You're an alcoholic. And your thinking is as strong or stronger. Because I know what to say, right? I know how to talk. It's there. It's right there waiting for me, just a script. It's waiting for me to get the right resentment. And if you've seen, you know, when those guys at my first meeting, I know why people go out. Step three, they take their will back. It's always the same. You can always see it. God can't handle this one. I'll handle this. And that's the beginning of that slip. And so if I would have, you know, what's the old saying? I think Plato said, when the gods want to punish us, they answer our prayers. Do you know, if I got what I wanted that night, things could have ended really badly. They could have gone in a totally different direction. But one day at a time, they didn't. So I want to leave you with one of the most powerful thoughts that people have passed on to me that I want to pass on to you. First, they told me, one day at a time, we wish you the gift of sobriety. That you don't graduate, you don't get this thing too fast, that you continue to be a student. And I heard at a meeting a few weeks back, you're no longer a newcomer when you realize that you will always be a newcomer. And for me, Eli defined this for me as the box. And few people have heard this before. So alcoholics' problems come in this box. They are usually in the form of finance or romance, and I'm afraid of losing what I have or not getting what I want. That's the box. All my problems fit in that box. Finance takes care of my outsides, because if I have enough on the outside, then you'll love me. Or if you love me, I'll be able to get what I want on the outside. Right? But it fits in that box. God has to be bigger than the box. If God becomes smaller than the box, I have a bad problem. That's where three comes in, that two and three come in. So instead of walking around telling God how big your problems are, tell your problem how big your God is. Thank you.